The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro. Part 2, continued. Most congressional offices closed during the 5 or 6 month congressional recess. During the recess, Johnson returned with Clayburgh to Corpus Christi, but kept either Latimer or Jones in Washington, so that the office of the 14th District never closed. Assistance was always available with applications for loans from the AAA, or the Federal Land Bank, or the new Homeowners Loan Corporation that was established to provide urban homeowners with the same protection against foreclosure as farmers. So effective was this assistance that, by the end of 1934, the caller said that Corpus Christi and the South Texas area are suffering less under the business depression than any other section of the nation. This statement may have been an exaggeration, but specific figures are impressive testimony to Johnson's diligence. The 14th District was the first of the nation's 435 congressional districts to have all its AAA loan applications approved. As for Federal Land Bank applications, during the first 10 months the program was in operation, the only 10 months for which this figure is available, not a single loan request from the 14th District was turned down. Although district-by-district figures are not available for the Homeowners Loan Corporation, 450 HOLC loans were made in Corpus Christi alone, a figure which appears to be the highest in the United States for a city of its size. As other New Deal programs, CWA, PWA, WPA, were inaugurated, the district received more than its share of these two. So many CCC camps, one at Floresville was named for Clayburgh, for example, that when in 1936 the government established limits to the number in any one district, the 14th was a distinct embarrassment. 435 congressional districts, among them districts represented by congressmen of long seniority, whose favor even a president had to court. Among them districts represented by congressmen who chaired powerful committees. Among them districts represented by congressmen who were allies of the New Deal. Among them districts represented by congressmen who worked hard for their districts. Few districts fared better under the New Deal's programs than this district with a junior congressman who opposed the New Deal, a congressman who seldom visited his office. This district, whose only asset on Capitol Hill, was a young secretary who worked for it with a frantic, frenzied, almost desperate aggressiveness and energy. Chapter 15. The Boss of the Little Congress. A veteran Texas politician, watching Lyndon Johnson at the age of 21 ramrodding 8 tough districts in a lieutenant governor's race, had called him a wonder kid of politics. Welly Hopkins, watching him work all the byways of Blanco, Comal, and Guadalupe counties, had spoken of his very unusual political ability. The same ability had been evident even earlier, in San Marcos, where Lyndon Johnson had not only captured campus politics, but had created campus politics. Now what his brother called his natural vocation was to be seen on a larger stage. There existed in Washington an organization called the Little Congress. It was a moribund organization, formed in 1919 to provide congressional secretaries with experience in public speaking and a knowledge of parliamentary procedures. It was modeled on the House of Representatives and held debates under House rules. But it had degenerated into little more than a social club, whose desultory meetings, held in the Cannon Building's chandeliered caucus room, were attended by no more than a few dozen secretaries. But the White Stars of San Marcos had also been considered a social club. In April 1933, Johnson approached a few carefully selected fellow residents of the Dodge Hotel and asked them to help him become the Speaker, or presiding officer, of the Little Congress. As in the House of Representatives, seniority and line of succession had determined the selection of previous speakers. At each election, only one new officer, a sergeant-at-arms, always an older man with long Washington tenure, was chosen. The other officers each simply moved up one notch, the former sergeant-at-arms being nominated for clerk, and the clerk being nominated for speaker. There was never any opposition. Johnson, however, had a plan to sidestep this practice. The plan depended on secrecy. By counting votes, says William H. Payne, who ran for sergeant-at-arms on the Johnson ticket, Johnson had determined that so many new secretaries had been brought to Capitol Hill in March by the new congressman elected in the Roosevelt landslide, that their votes would give him the speakership. If the older secretaries, who still far outnumbered the newer ones, did not realize what he was planning and turn out in force at the April meeting. To minimize chances of discovery, he waited to launch his campaign until a day or two before the election. And when he campaigned not in person, but by telephone, remaining in Clayburgh's office and calling new secretaries in other congressional offices to ask for their votes, so that there would be as little activity visible as possible. He had discovered another cache of votes, although only congressional secretaries had attended past meetings of the little Congress, and there existed a general impression that only secretaries were eligible for membership. The organization's bylaws actually made any person on the legislative payroll, which included Capitol Hill mailmen, policemen, and elevator operators appointed under congressional patronage, eligible, so long as he paid his $2 dues. Johnson told Latimer to round up his mailmen friends and bring them to the meeting, and he told Latimer not to tell them about the meeting until the last possible moment. He asked a friendly elevator operator to do the same with the other elevator men, and repeated the enjoinder of secrecy. And on the night of April 27, 1933, as a few handfuls of little Congress regulars sat all but lost in the rows of seats in the spacious caucus room, they were taken completely by surprise when, just as the meeting was about to begin, there suddenly burst into the room enough people with unfamiliar faces to elect as speaker a tall, thin, 24-year-old from Texas, whom few of the older men even knew. "Who is that guy?" one asked as Johnson came forward to take the gavel. When the next day the older men collected their wits, they had other questions about the honesty of the election. Many of the votes that had elected Johnson, they said, had been cast by men not eligible to vote. Many of the mailmen and elevator operators who had shown up for the first time had not paid their dues, they said, and hence were not members of the little Congress. Moreover, they said, many of the new voters could not be members even if they paid dues. Johnson's supporters, they charged, had simply rounded up every Capitol Hill employee they could find, whether or not the employee had been appointed under congressional patronage. There were complaints that, as Lucas puts it, he stole that election. If the charge was true, the election was, of course, the second he had stolen. Johnson's acceptance speech was somewhat derivative from a speech delivered a month before by another man lately come to Congress. "My election," he said, "will mark a new deal for all little Congresses." He also promised to be mindful of the forgotten man by naming committees on an equitable basis of membership and seniority. Derivative or not, however, a new deal was what he delivered. He transformed the little Congress of Capitol Hill as he had transformed the White Stars of College Hill. He turned a social organization into a political organization, into an organization, moreover, to serve his own ends. One of those ends was entree, the entree a congressional staffer needed but found so hard to obtain. Henceforth, Johnson announced, meetings would be held not every month but every week, and would include not only debates but speeches by prominent figures. And although the new speaker declared that the reason for this innovation was to make the meetings livelier, his teenage assistants knew that there was another reason as well. Says Latimer, "It gave him an excuse to go and see Huey Long or Tom Connolly or a Texas congressman who was head of a committee he thought he might need for something and invite them to speak, and once he got in to see somebody, the chief, being the way he was, would make them remember him." Another end was publicity. First, he organized the little Congress debates. Previously, anyone who wished could speak. Now, only assigned speakers could take the floor during the 60 minutes allotted to each side. He made the assignments, naming teams to represent both sides of an issue currently before Congress. One floor leader would generally be the aide of the congressman who had introduced the bill, the other the aide of a congressman who opposed it. Kept checking with the leaders to make sure they were actively organizing their teams, further formalized the atmosphere by assigning speakers places at the long witness table that ran across the front of the caucus room. Sitting at the center of the long raised horseshoe dais, used by congressional committees, he ran the debates strictly. Says Payne, The first time he presided, everyone knew. By George, here was a man who was running the show. The little Congress was run by the same rules as the House of Representatives, and he knew those rules. He was his own parliamentarian, and there wasn't anyone who could argue with him about whether the proceedings were proceeding according to the rules, because he knew them. He was in command. At the end of each debate, the little Congress voted on the bill. Once he had the debates organized, he asked newspapers to cover them. Congressional aides generally reflected their boss's feelings, he told reporters, and little Congress votes on pending legislation were therefore previews of upcoming votes in the big Congress. Moreover, since the little Congress floor leaders were the same men who were helping their bosses prepare to lead the upcoming fights in the House, the debates would provide a preview not only of votes, but of maneuvers to come. The reporters came and were impressed. One of the most interesting forums in Washington, the Washington Post said. Finding that House votes could indeed be predicted on the basis of voting in the little Congress, they began to cover it fairly regularly. Payne recalls, "Every week there'd be a meeting, and every week there would be stories in at least a couple of the Washington papers. And stories on the little Congress generally contained a statement from, or at least a mention of the name of, its speaker. A chance for press coverage made even the most famous political figures receptive to Johnson's invitations to address it. When Johnson said he was inviting the colorful and controversial Huey Long to speak," recalls another little Congress member, Wingate Lucas, "none of us thought he could pull it off. But sure enough, Long came. The caucus room was, another member says, just crowded with newsreel cameras. Pathé News and Metro News and all that. There were lights all over the place, these movie lights. A tremendous number of reporters were there." And when Long came into the room, surrounded by a phalanx of tough-looking bodyguards, the Speaker of the little Congress was there to welcome him, shaking his hand and smiling at him as the flash bulbs popped and the cameras rolled. Soon, 200 or more congressional aides were crowding into the caucus room every week. Johnson organized other events, including a 3-day trip which many secretaries remember vividly 45 years later, on which 293 secretaries toured New York City with a motorcycle escort provided by Mayor LaGuardia, and in the evening were the mayor's guests at Radio City Music Hall. Then the congressional aides went on to West Point, from which they returned to Washington by train. "I remember Lyndon roaming up and down the aisles, from car to car, eyes flashing, smiling, too excited to sit still," Payne says. The annual banquet, held at the Mayflower Hotel, became an elaborate affair, with prominent speakers and formal dress. Says Lucas, who some years later would be speaker himself, "Little Congress became quite a big thing. When we had a debate, members of Congress would show up, to hear the points on each side and to get an indication of how the members themselves would vote. Members of Congress wanted their bills debated by the little Congress for publicity, and because it would help prepare them for debate on the floor. A congressman would come to you and say, 'I'd like to get the little Congress to debate one of my bills.' I remember one congressman from California doing this. He had a copy of his bill in his pocket, and he gave it to me, and he gave me a pitch for it. So if you were Speaker, you were respected by members of Congress and called upon by members of Congress." In a remarkably short time, taking into account congressional recesses which he spent back in Texas, in less than a year spent on Capitol Hill, Lyndon Johnson had, through an organization in which advancement had previously depended upon longevity on the Hill, lifted himself dramatically out of the anonymous crowd of congressional aides. Little Congress bylaws allowed a speaker only a single term. While Johnson made no attempt to change the bylaws, in the opinion of at least one ally, because there had already been too many rumors about the circumstances under which he had been elected, he kept control of the organization through hand-picked candidates. He never campaigned publicly for them. "Word just circulated around that so-and-so was Johnson's candidate," Payne says. "He did everything behind the scenes." But behind the scenes, he was very effective. A half-dozen Johnson allies, all distinguished by their willingness to defer to his orders, would telephone other members before each election to suggest who should be supported. Members who, in the open balloting, failed to follow the suggestion did not thereafter receive invitations to speak, and it became understood that antagonizing Lyndon Johnson was not a good idea for anyone who wanted to advance in the only organization in which, for congressional secretaries, advancement was possible. "He had a machine," says Secretary Lacey Sharp, "and if you wanted to run, you had better have the blessings of Lyndon Johnson. The machine's existence had become an acknowledged reality in the self-contained little world of Capitol Hill. Another secretary, newly arrived on the Hill, recalls seeing Johnson for the first time. Struck by his appearance, his height, his huge ears, his flashing eyes and smile, the confidence with which he walked, arms akimbo, down a House office building corridor, the secretary asked a friend who he was. Replied the friend, "That's the boss of the little Congress." Did his vocation, his very unusual ability, work only with contemporaries, only with the congressional secretaries who were his equals in rank? The speakership of the little Congress may have furnished him entree to officials other secretaries never got to talk to. It was the use he made of the entree that awed those contemporaries who had a chance to see him use it. At the Department of Agriculture, for example, the hundreds of patronage jobs created by the new AAA programs were dispensed by three tough Tammany politicians. Julian N. Fryant, Special Assistant to the Secretary of Agriculture, and Jim Farley's personal representative in the department, and Fryant's assistants, Vincent McGuire and Lee Barnes. Even congressmen had difficulty getting these men on the phone. For most congressional secretaries, personal communication was all but impossible. But Congressional Secretary Lyndon Johnson wanted another assistant to help with his district's mail. And with no more room on the district's payroll, he wanted the assistant, Russell M. Brown, a young law student from Rhode Island, put on agriculture's. Aware of the inaccessibility of agriculture's personnel trio, Brown was startled when Johnson said casually that they would run over and see them. He was even more startled by the reception Johnson received. When Johnson told McGuire, whose office they went into first, "Mac, I gotta have a job for Russ here," Mac replied simply, "I can arrange it, Lyndon." "That's great," McGuire added with a smile. "Texas helping Rhode Island." Then McGuire asked Johnson, "Would you like to say hello to the boss?" They all strolled down to Fryant's office, where the reception was equally warm. "The chief and Fryant got along fine," Latimer remembers. "I don't even know how they got to know each other, but anything Fryant could do for the chief, he was happy to do." Brown was to receive a larger shock. While they were chatting in Fryant's office, the door opened, and in walked Fryant's boss, the great personnel director himself, chief patronage dispenser of the New Deal, Postmaster General James A. Farley. Brown stared almost speechless at this living legend, but Farley, he says, was very affable and shook hands. Lyndon Johnson, who had met Farley when the Postmaster General had accompanied Vice President Garner to the King Ranch some months before, was affable right back. "This is my friend Russell Brown from Rhode Island," he said. Farley, who never forgot a name or a political affiliation, remembered something McGuire and Fryant hadn't. He asked Brown if he was Charles Brown's son, and then said to Fryant, "What are you doing helping a Republican?" A moment of tension ensued, but it evaporated when Johnson, putting his arm around Brown, said expansively, "He's my Republican." Everyone burst out laughing, Brown recalls, with the Postmaster General, beaming at Johnson, laughing loudest of all. Other Capitol Hill aides witnessed similar scenes. Not only, they came to realize, did Lyndon Johnson know powerful officials who were in a position to help him, these officials knew him and liked him, and wanted to help him. A measure of this feeling was the number of patronage jobs Johnson obtained in the AAA and other newly formed New Deal agencies, such as the Homeowners Loan Corporation and the Federal Land Bank. Such jobs were generally rationed by the New Deal on the basis of a congressman's importance. The office of the average congressman might be given 4 or 5, the office of a senior or powerful congressman perhaps 20, the office of a committee chairman as many as 30, or in rare cases 40. The office of Richard Clayburgh, a congressman with neither seniority nor power, was given 50. Did his ability with the powerful consist merely of the capacity to make friends with them? One Texan notably unmoved by Johnson's charm was Vice President Garner, whose desire for new friendships was limited. "Me and my wife tough old Cactus Jack explained once. My son and his wife. We four, and no more. As for his paternal instincts toward bright young men, even his son was able to obtain a loan from him only after he had agreed to pay a very high rate of interest. In May 1933, the Texas legislature redrew the state's congressional districts. Seeing Garner's hand in the redistricting, Texas congressmen feared it would be present as well in the confusion that was bound to follow. During the year-and-a-half interim before the redistricting went into effect in January 1935, federal patronage in counties that had been shifted from one district to another would be in dispute between the old congressman they had elected and the new one into whose district they had been shifted. In some counties, moreover, a vacuum would exist. Three new districts had been formed by taking counties away from old districts. These counties would have no opportunity to elect a new congressman until November 1934. Aware of Garner's ruthlessness and appetite for power, and of his long and close friendship with patronage dispenser Farley, Texas congressmen feared he would step into the vacuum by claiming, as the state's highest federal official, the patronage power in counties in which it was in dispute. Despite a number of secret caucuses among themselves, however, they still didn't know how to meet this threat. One of their secretaries did. Lyndon Johnson had not, of course, been present at the caucuses, but Clayburgh had told him about them, and Johnson had a suggestion. If, instead of fighting among themselves, all 21 congressmen, plus Senators Connolly and Shepard, agreed on a division of patronage powers, both vacuum and confusion would be eliminated. In the absence of a vacuum, Garner's maneuvers would become more difficult to carry out. Without confusion to cloak them, they would be revealed as a naked grab for power. A united front among the congressmen would deter Farley, too, since he would be interfering in a state's internal politics against the wishes of its entire congressional delegation. Such a united front, Johnson said, should take the form of a non-legal but signed gentleman's contract between all Texas congressmen and senators, stating that patronage power in every Texas county should remain in the hands of its present congressmen until the redistricting went into effect. And when Clayburgh asked how Connolly and Shepard, who might themselves see confusion as an opportunity for patronage gains, could be induced to go along with the congressman, his secretary had an answer for that, too. Since the two senators, jealous of their statewide powers, would be as worried as the congressman about the Garner threat, only a small inducement would be necessary. The right, previously reserved to the local congressman, to name the postmaster in their home towns. Johnson drafted the agreement. Until January 1, 1935, present representatives of the district shall control in counties of their present existing districts. We ask that this agreement be respected by all federal departments and offices. Clayburgh was reluctant to engage in a fight, particularly with his old friend Garner, but Johnson told him that the existence of a clear agreement was the best way to avoid one. And when he reminded Clayburgh, to whom personal honor was very important, that in return for support in his last election he had promised federal positions to supporters in Bexar County, which had been removed from his district in the redistricting, and that if the right of appointment was given to Garner he would be unable to live up to his promises, Clayburgh agreed to circulate the contract to the whole delegation. Everyone signed it. And when, in January 1934, Garner made his move, Texas congressman who submitted recommendations to Farley on federal postmasterships in the redistricted counties were told to clear them with the vice president, Johnson knew how to use the weapon he had forged. He leaked the agreement to the press, not to a local Texas newspaper, but to the Associated Press. Huge headlines, revolt against patronage arrangement, and angry editorials, Postmaster Farley's insistence upon giving Garner control will make political orphans of dozens of Texas counties, in Texas, combined with nationwide publicity, produced precisely the effect Johnson had calculated. Within the week, Garner had beaten a hasty retreat. In the presence of a grievance committee of Texas congressmen, he dictated a document of unconditional surrender, a letter of his own to Farley. Dear Jim, a committee representing the Texas delegation are in my office at this moment. They are very much worried about the proposal that I pass on qualifications of postmasters in the new districts in Texas, and to be frank with you, Jim, I'm worried about it myself because of the friction that might arise between the Texas members of Congress and myself. I want to ask you if you won't relieve me of the burden of saying anything about the qualifications of any postmaster anywhere in Texas." Farley agreed to Garner's request, dashing off a letter of his own, telling Texas congressmen to submit their recommendations directly to him, as in the past. William S. White, then an Associated Press correspondent in Washington, recounts that for days Garner went among fellow Texans with a scowling, half-amused demand. "Who in the hell is this boy Lyndon Johnson? Where the hell did Claiborne get a boy with savvy like that?" Others familiar with the episode say White's description is accurate, except for the hyphenated adjective. Cactus Jack Garner was not even half amused. Garner's question, moreover, was a natural one. This boy Lyndon Johnson, a 25-year-old congressional assistant, had defeated in a small but bitter skirmish the Vice President of the United States. Chapter 16. In Tune. Few, if any, congressional secretaries implemented New Deal programs more successfully than Lyndon Johnson. His assistants were, therefore, surprised when they realized what Johnson thought of the New Deal. "The man with whom he was most in tune," says L.E. Jones, and Gene Latimer and Russell Brown agree, "was Roy Miller, the legendary lobbyist who had made the district's office his own. With his wavy silver mane, his suits and waistcoats of rich fabric, the small but perfect diamond on his lapel, and, of course, his pearl-gray Borsellino, Miller looked to the three admiring young assistant secretaries like the very model of a Southern senator. Erect and dignified, he didn't even own a short-sleeved shirt," says his son Dale. "He strode through the Capitol as if he owned it, which some said, in the areas in which he was interested, he did. For legislators like Sam Johnson, who would refuse to accept a drink from Roy Miller without buying him one back, were apparently almost as rare in Washington as in Austin, and with the seemingly unlimited funds at his disposal for campaign contributions, he bought national legislators as easily as state." Echoing the Austin American Statesman's judgment that he was perhaps the most effective single lobbyist Washington has ever known, the Saturday Evening Post commented that "perhaps no one outside official life has a wider acquaintance among congressmen. For 20 years he has had the status of a quasi-public figure." The congressman most important to Texas Gulf Sulphur, which needed deep harbors for the freighters carrying away the sulphur it mined along the Gulf Coast, was Rivers and Harbors Committee Chairman Mansfield. Precisely at noon each day, Miller arrived at Mansfield's office and closeted himself with the crippled congressman for half an hour. Precisely at 12:30, a house page arrived to push Mansfield's wheelchair, with Miller striding alongside it, somewhat in the manner of a Roman emperor displaying a captive in a triumphal procession, through the underground passageway between the Longworth Building and the Capitol, and into the house restaurant, where it was placed at a large round table just inside the door, known as Roy Miller's table, in honor of the man who picked up the checks at it. A surprising number of representatives, the Saturday Evening Post reported, knew his hat and coat when it hangs on its accustomed peg in the house restaurant, a discreet reference to the fact that many congressmen checked to see that he was present before they entered the restaurant, lest they be forced to pay for their meals themselves. Nor was Miller's generosity confined to the house dining room. So awed was Jim Farley by Miller's munificence during Farley's trips to Texas that the mimeographed advice given by the normally discreet Postmaster General to a group of congressmen leaving for a Miller-sponsored Texas junket began, "Carry only what money you need before you get to Texas. You will not be able to spend a dime in the state of Texas." The consummate lobbyist, Miller did not confine his friendships to the powerful. He knew policemen, he knew the elevator operators, and he knew everybody in the offices, Latimer says. He would come in and talk to them and never mention the congressman. He'd come by if you were working 10, 11 o'clock at night. "Can I take you all out and buy you a drink?" And then he would buy you a wonderful dinner. The objects of these attentions might be aware of his motives. As Latimer puts it, when he wanted to see a congressman, he could ask the secretary, "You reckon the congressman's busy?" And they'd break a leg getting him in to see him. But they were flattered and charmed, nevertheless. The three young assistant secretaries in the 14th District office admired Miller and were awed by him. By his manner, He was so suave and smooth, Jones says. By his salary, he was making $80,000 a year, and this was during the Depression, Latimer says. By his luxurious suite at the Mayflower, by the ease with which, in those days before regular air service, he seemed to stride around the country as easily as he did around the Capitol. Roy Miller would call from Texas and say, "I'm going to be in the office in the morning," Brown recalls. It was always quite a thing that he'd call from Texas on Monday and be in the office on Tuesday, because he would come up with his private airplane. And so, they say, was their immediate superior. Lyndon hero-worshipped Roy Miller, Jones says. If in public Miller seemed the archetypal Southern senator, in private he might have been the model for another caricature, the wealthy businessman venomously ranting and raving in Peter Arno's New Yorker cartoons about that man in the White House. Miller and a group of friends would often gather in Clayburgh's inner office for a late afternoon drink. These men were Roosevelt haters, who saw in the president's programs the erosion of the power and the privilege so dear to them, and their hatred was made more bitter by the president's popularity, which forced them, for the sake of expediency, to keep their feelings hidden. Expediency dictated concealment of their feelings on many subjects. One of the Miller group was Martin Dies, later chairman of the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Jones vividly remembers Dies coming off the floor of the House in 1935 after making a speech supporting a new bid by the veterans for payment of the bonus. "There, that'll sound good back home," Dies said, and then, unable to contain his true feelings any longer, snarled, "Goddamned Reds!" So, in the privacy of Clayburgh's office, their laughter at the latest scatological joke about Franklin's physical disabilities, or about Eleanor, was all the louder, and their railings against Reds and about the dictatorship being foisted on the American people, and about the socialists, communists, Bolsheviks, and, worst of all, college professors who surrounded the dictator, were all the more vehement. Of that group, Dies, Clayburgh himself, Horatio H. Rash Adams, a Clayburgh golfing partner and reactionary lobbyist for General Electric, other ultra-conservative Texas congressmen such as Nat, Cousin Nat, Patton, James P. Buck Buchanan, and Hatton W. Summers. No one laughed louder or railed more vehemently than Miller. Lyndon Johnson was always invited in for a drink. And since the door between the suite's two rooms was open, Jones, Latimer, and Brown could hear what their chief was saying. His tone with these powerful men was very different from the tone he used with them. He was as obsequious to those above him as he was overbearing to those below. In talking with these guys, L.E. Jones says, Lyndon was very much the young man, very starry-eyed, very boyish. It was very much the junior to the senior. Yes, sir, no, sir. Even if there was a vacant seat in Clayburgh's office, Johnson would often be sitting on the floor, his face upturned to whoever was speaking, an expression of the deepest interest and respect on his face, in the manner that had led Vernon Whiteside to say he would drink up what they were saying, sit at their knees and drink it up. Says a fellow congressional secretary who observed Lyndon in this type of situation, with men who had power, men who could help him, Lyndon Johnson was a professional son. The reaction would have been familiar, too. Proof that on Capitol, as on College Hill, where flattery is concerned, excess is impossible. These men were very fond of Lyndon Johnson, and the fondness had strongly paternal overtones. Rash Adams, for example, gave Lyndon Johnson advice not only about women, but about culture. Feeling that his cultural horizons needed broadening, he bought him theater and opera tickets. And the flattery that Johnson's three assistants overheard was no stronger than the philosophy. To their surprise, their chief agreed with Miller, agreed enthusiastically. Miller just hated Roosevelt, Jones says. And Lyndon was in tune with Miller. Hell, sometimes he was louder against Roosevelt than Miller was. Johnson used Miller's arguments in dealing with Clayburgh. Opposed to the AAA program as socialistic, Clayburgh said he was going to vote against it. Johnson, like Miller, told the congressman he must vote for it, not because the program was sound, but because his constituents were overwhelmingly in favor of it, as was Congress. His vote didn't matter, they said, the bill would pass anyway. This scene was repeated. Clayburgh would return to his office from meetings of the Agriculture Committee just shocked at new Roosevelt proposals. Johnson agreed that the proposed programs were terrible, but Jones recalls told Clayburg that he had to vote for them because it was just good politics. And Johnson did not, for a while at least, espouse a conservative philosophy only in the company of conservatives. During bull sessions at the Dodge, Johnson, echoing one of Miller's pet phrases, would say of Roosevelt, "He's spending us into bankruptcy." The president's first priority, he would repeat emphatically, should be to balance the budget. A hot topic at the Dodge was Huey Long's recently published Every Man a King. Johnson admired the Louisiana populist, but not for his populism. His admiration was for Long's speech-making ability and his growing political power. He was critical of his proposal to redistribute the nation's wealth. And Long shared the president's fault. Lyndon was critical of the part of Long's book about spending so much money. You know, just spend, 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 Jones says. Discussing the book with Jones, he dictated several sentences which he told L.E. to write inside its cover. Sentences, Jones says, to the effect that Roosevelt is spending too much money. If we're not careful, he'll lead the country into disaster. Most of the young men of A and B floors were liberal. Lyndon Johnson was the basement conservative. He was in tune with Miller, not only in talk, but in action. His closest associate among Texas politicians was Welly Hopkins, who, between trips to Washington to obtain RFC loans for clients of his law firm, he always spent his free time on these trips with Johnson, once they went to New York together to see the Empire State Building, was distinguishing himself back in Texas as one of the state's most vociferous red-baiters. He was also leading the fight in the Texas State Senate against attempts to regulate the use of child labor. When Clayburg's bid for re-election was challenged in the Democratic primary by a more liberal candidate, Johnson, Miller, and Hopkins orchestrated a campaign to turn back the challenge in the time-tested method of Texas reactionaries. Refusing to discuss the liberals' positions, they tarred him as a communist, guilty of radicalism and similar filth and slime. Although it is difficult to ascertain the precise stands of Clayburg's opponent, Carl Wright Johnson, because in a district so completely controlled by the King Ranch, no newspaper would give Carl Johnson more than cursory coverage, he was, in general, attacking Clayburg for advocating a federal sales tax which would fall hardest on the poor, while at the same time advocating other federal legislation which would largely exempt Texas Gulf Sulphur from paying any federal taxes at all. Johnson imported the fiery little stemwinder. Lyndon called me from Corpus Christi and said Dick's in trouble down here, who used his customary strategy with its customary success. Turning to Carl Johnson at the end of a county fair debate, Hopkins recalls, "I said to this guy, 'Your heart's black and your mind's red.' And he was finished." Roy Miller issued a formal denial of the charge. "The company I represent has absolutely no interest in federal legislation," he said. Miller's son Dale, already a knowledgeable lobbyist in his own right, had, in a brief first meeting with Johnson, gotten the impression that he was a New Dealer. His manner personified the New Deal, he says. He looked the part. He was young, dynamic, outgoing, the new wave of the future. Dale Miller was, therefore, surprised that my father, who was very, very conservative in his political philosophy, was comfortable with Clayburg's secretary. But his father, Dale recalls, assured him that Johnson was not a wild-eyed liberal, and as Dale himself got to know Johnson better, he understood what his father had been trying to tell him. He, Johnson, gave the impression of being much, much more liberal than he actually was. He gave a lot more impression of being with the New Deal than was actually the case. Jones had realized this, too, and the realization never ceased to astonish him. Watching Johnson's constant display of thank-you letters from constituents, Jones had seen in his chief a deep need for gratitude, and as Jones puts it, "For someone who needs gratitude, the New Deal is the natural philosophy, because it lets you do things for people, and therefore gives you the greatest opportunity to get gratitude." He was seeing, at the closest range, how effectively Lyndon Johnson was translating the new government programs into action. "Not one of the 1,000 congressional aides," Jones says, "could possibly have been better at implementing the philosophy of the New Deal." And yet, Jones says, and Brown and Latimer and other contemporaries who knew Johnson at the time agree, He was implementing the philosophy without believing in it. But if, in the opinion of these congressional secretaries, Lyndon Johnson's true feelings were in harmony with those of reactionaries, such as Roy Miller, the secretaries also heard him singing quite a different tune when he was in the company of powerful older men of a different persuasion. The same young men who had heard him denouncing the New Deal when with Miller heard him praising it when talking with congressmen such as Wright Patman, who had not yet abandoned the populism he had espoused in the Texas legislature. Once a congressional aide who had just heard him talking conservative with Martin Dies came across him not an hour later talking liberal with Patman, espousing a point of view diametrically opposite to the one he had been espousing 60 minutes before. When talking with older men, many could help him. Lyndon Johnson gave them, this aide says, whatever they wanted to hear. Younger men he gave nothing. The shift in his behavior at the Dodge was quite sudden. For a time he had been B-Floor's conservative. Then, abruptly, he started, in the words of another B-Floor resident, shifting gears, drawing back from his position. Other residents noticed that on two consecutive nights, Johnson would argue on opposite sides of the same issue. And then, in a very short time, he stopped arguing about issues at all. He would no longer, in fact, even discuss them. His silence in this area was especially conspicuous because of his volubility in all others. If political tactics, for example, were being discussed, Johnson would be the center of the discussion. If the discussion concerned political issues, philosophy, principles, ideas, ideals, Johnson would not even be a part of it. Realizing, as he entered a room in which a bull session was being held, that its topic was a serious issue, he would try to duck back out of the room before he was seen. If he was already participating in a bull session and it turned to such an issue, he would quietly slip out of the room, or if he remained, would refuse, even if drawn into the discussion, to allow himself to be pinned down to a specific stand. He would refuse to take a stand even when directly challenged to do so, turning aside the challenge with a joke or a Texas anecdote. Pressed to the wall, he would say he simply hadn't yet made up his mind on the issue. During those first exciting years of the New Deal, discussion of great issues swirled through Washington, and nowhere was discussion more animated than in that basement home of 100 bright young men in government. Amidst the swirl of ideas, Lyndon Johnson seemed unmoved. The son of the man who had said, "It's high time a man stood up for what he believes in," seemed ready to stand up for nothing. At San Marcos, it was assumed this behavior stemmed from ambition. "He never took strong positions, positions where you knew where Lyndon stood," one student had said. "He was only interested in himself and what could help himself." The feeling in Washington was the same. The young men at the Dodge saw the ambition expressed in other ways as well. This book is continued on cassette number 3, side 1.